No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So you should feel free to call in if you have questions at 888-628-6008. Tonight, I have a very special guest, Janetta Rose Barris. Janetta is a poet, a fiction writer, a performing artist, a community organizer. As we like to say, she's got it all going on, and we're just so excited to have her on the show tonight. Thanks for being with us, Janetta.
Thank you so much, Senator Brown, for having me.
Yeah, you know, the first thing, before I really get into the meat of the discussion, I saw something on your bio that I found really interesting. I just thought we could talk about it for a second, that you have a group that works to inspire and empower fatherless girls and women. Tell me a little bit about that, because I find that very, very interesting. I'm the father of two daughters, and I believe that there's not enough you can do to empower young women. So tell me what you're doing.
Well, I am a fatherless daughter. I didn't get to meet my father until I was in my late 30s. My biological father, that is. But all along, as I was growing up, I had so many issues, behavioral issues, emotional issues. And I never put it all together until there was a movement afoot that was organized by Wade Horn and a number of other guys, mainly white guys, who were talking about the importance of fathers, but the importance of fathers as it related to their sons. And I happened to be covering their conference one year and asked, well, if fathers are important to sons, shouldn't they also be important to daughters? And maybe even more important. And so I went on a little bit of an excursion and research about it, and really learned the importance and value of fathers in the development of their daughters. And so I eventually ended up writing a book, Whatever Happened to Daddy's Little Girl, The Impact of Fatherlessness on Black Women, telling my story and the story of a number of other women who had grown up without their fathers. After that book was published and I went on national tour, I actually decided to create an organization that would give voice to young girls and women who had grown up without their fathers, and to educate the public about the important role of fathers in the lives of their daughters. Fathers help to their daughters to navigate the social and professional world. Actually, they teach their daughters how to develop an internal locus rather than an external locus, and obviously they serve as the model for their daughters in romantic circumstances.
That's so important, I think. That, and we'll move on. I think, first of all, God bless you for doing it and for writing the book, and I hope people will get it and read it. You can tell us where we can get it. But I always felt that I grew up without a father in my home, basically. My father abandoned our family, and I was raised by my mom until I was 15, and then she died. But I always felt that I have two girls, and I always felt that the first man that they needed to fall in love with was their dad. The first guy that they needed to look at and say, this is a good guy. This is a guy that wants to help me. This is a guy who stands for certain things and respects me and empowers me. Because I think the way we raise women in our society, there's so many of them that have low self-esteem that it amazes me. And I think in part it's because of that. It's because of the lack of good male role models as they grow up.
Well, you know? And the thing is that until recently, over 50% of all marriages, at least 50% of all marriages in America were failing. So that meant many children were without their fathers in most cases because the courts often gave custody of children to their mothers. Some of that is obviously changing now. And you do have, in some instances, mothers leaving the children to the fathers. So we have a little bit of a change in that dynamic, but in the communities of color, at least 60% of those families are headed by females. And many of those females grew up without their father. So you have multi-generational father absence, which means you have multi-generational trauma. And that trauma sometimes can be passed on to the children.
Well, since we're on the subject of trauma, let's talk about the trauma. I agree with you 100%. The trauma in D.C. I just read an article that you wrote where your granddaughter asked you many questions about the recent murders that have gone on, or the recent shootings. They haven't actually been murders. There were two kids getting off of Metro bus. There was, of course, we have a 14-year-old who shot an NFL football player. We have this 13-year-old kid who was, we don't know what happened to him. If he was shot by a vigilante and killed or what, he was supposedly breaking into cars, but he was out on the street at 4 o'clock in the morning. And your granddaughter's worried about this, and you said in the article that she asked you questions like you're responsible for this, and I started to think to myself, aren't we all responsible for this? Shouldn't this be our main priority is to keep children safe? I mean, if we can't keep them safe, I mean, that's about as basic as it gets, is it not?
Well, I think that it's, I certainly agree with you. I think that generally the society and the government, but especially the parents, have a responsibility to their children. Whether you are in a family where there is no father or there is no mother, that the parent that is there, the custodial parent, has a responsibility to keep that child or keep those children safe. And I think a lot of that is part of the problem, that we have parents who aren't doing their jobs. But we also have a society that has, I think, embraced a certain level of lawlessness, under the guise of, I guess, liberalism or support. I'm not sure how we got there, but I do have a lot of concerns about what's happening to children in Washington, D.C., and generally in this country. And I think part of it, more recently, we can say that some of this has to do with the trauma of the pandemic. When the pandemic first arrived here in America and in Washington, D.C., I asked the head of the D.C. Department of Behavioral Health whether the beginning rise of crime that we were seeing was as a result or was connected in any way to the pandemic. And she said that there hadn't been any causal research, no research to look at whether there's a cause and effect relationship here. I was saying, well, I think you ought to do that because you've got people fully traumatized. People are dying, just dying before our very eyes, our friends, our family. And during the pandemic, the height of the pandemic, people were caught in their homes and with no place to go. I know my own granddaughter was very troubled by not being able to get out of the house.
Yeah. Well, they're right. So high school kids, middle school kids, my wife's a high school librarian. Their social life is so important to them, not only to them, but to their development. But since we're talking about this and responsibility, one of the main controversies right now that we see in the District of Columbia is between the mayor and the city council over the overhaul of the D.C. criminal code. Now, the mayor objects. This is an old code that's been many years in the making to be reformed. But the thing that seems to be troubling to the mayor and also troubling to me, to tell you the truth, is the reduction of mandatory sentencing for gun violations. She's vetoed the bill. The council has overrode that veto with only one dissenting member. What do you think about that? Do you think that I can tell you that I feel that reducing mandatory sentencing for gun violations, even though it's not invoked very often, sends the wrong signal. Do you think it sends the wrong signal?
Absolutely. I agree with the mayor on this. I think first I want to say that I think that it's commendable that advocates and lawyers, defense lawyers mainly, and law enforcement got together to try to make sense of the city's century-old, criminal code. I think, what was happening, we were adding various sentences onto the code without having any kind of real kind of global look at what it all meant and what it should mean and how we should have or what the criminal code should look like and contain. So there's a benefit for doing that. However, when you have the U.S. attorney, the chief judge of the D.C. Superior Court, and the mayor of the District of Columbia all saying the same thing, we've got a problem, and we've got a problem with at least 3 to 4 sections of this work. Now, this is a massive piece of legislation.
Yeah.
It's over 300 pages. There are all these various different definitions of what is and what isn't a criminal crime and, what the circumstances have to be in order for someone to be charged, who is responsible for the burden of proof, where is the burden of proof. All of that is in the code. So it's a pretty hefty piece of legislation. But these pieces that the mayor has raised, the concerns that she's raised, and in her veto letter, she talked about what those concerns were, the reducing of sentences for illegally carrying a gun on our streets. She had some concerns about people actually being able to demand a jury trial for a misdemeanor, which could back up the courts, which will back up the courts because, of course, people who commit crimes don't want to necessarily be held accountable. And if you're going to give them an out where, they can demand a trial and then we don't have enough judges on the bench, we have these vacancies and all of this. So I think she was right to raise questions. She raised questions before, and all of them raised questions, actually, before the council unanimously passed this code. Because they but they ignored the concerns, specifically Charles Allen, who was the chair of the Committee on Judiciary and the Public Safety, and he was the one who ushered it through the council. And so then she vetoes it. Now, what they could have done, Senator Brown, they could have actually decided to amend the legislation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even as they overrode her veto, they could have still amended the legislation. But they didn't want to do that for politics.
Well,
it's all politics.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? Unfortunately, my dealings with the councilman from Ward 6 is that he tends to be sanctimonious, which I think is a very dangerous thing for a politician. But I think that's part of it, too. They don't want their, you know, what the city council has passed, let no man set asunder. You know, I think that that's part of it. And you're right. I think they should have amended it. And they certainly had the opportunity to. And you know, there are people, when it comes to a jury trial, you know, there are people like me that sit down in front of the United States Senate in protest who get arrested, who want to have jury trials because we're trying to make an issue. We're trying to make a point of something. But you're right. It does really. She's right. It clogs up a judicial system, which is already screwed up because we don't have control over it, right?
Exactly.
It's really not ours to control. You know, I was arrested in front of the Senate, and I was tried in traffic court. I had to listen to a video on drunk driving before my case came up because we don't prosecute.
God. That's unbelievable.
Really. Unbelievable. And then after the thing was over, the Capitol police officers that arrested me came up and hugged me. And I said, I said to them, is this usually how it goes with perps? And they said, no, it doesn't usually go this way. But anyway, yeah, we don't control our own legal system. So that's a problem. And how about the city council? Aren't we always pandering to the latest fad? I mean, it kills me.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I have to go up to Capitol Hill and fight for our rights, and then we've got people that are proffering legislation to let undocumented aliens vote. This is like a give me for those conservative Republicans on the Hill. You know, they just love that. They're like, oh, my God. You know, and then they stand there and they say, well, the reason for that is they pay taxes and they add to our community. Well, how do they pay taxes if they're not allowed to work? You know, I mean, it's like almost crazy. And to let 16-year-olds vote. I've raised a few 16-year-olds, and I was afraid to let them use the car, let alone vote.
So
I don't know, and it seems like we're always pandering to, you know, whatever the latest, greatest idea is. We've either considered it, legislated it, or lobbying for it, and it just seems crazy to me. And I think the city
should be applauded for its sense of humanity and its desire to bring everyone under the tent. But it's not. It's the way. It's their approach that this. And I think that's what you're talking about more than anything. It's the approach that they take, and whether some of this is reasonable, is it logical? Does it come from sound thinking? Have they even thought past the moment that they're approving the legislation, of the potential long-term impact on some of the legislation. And even most important, I think, the passage of the legislation with the undocumented workers, or these aren't even workers yet. They're people who have just arrived in the city.
Right.
Mary Che, who was the outgoing Ward 3, well, she's now the retired Ward 3 council member, had said, well, you know, you want these people to be able to vote after being here for 30 days? Seriously, can you make it a little longer at least? And, of course, her appeal was ignored. And so, yes, the Republicans will be all over that. But even before the Republicans, Senator Brown, there are district residents who didn't have a chance to weigh in on this. This was passed by emergency legislation. Now, the council members will say, well, we've been discussing this for years. But you haven't had, before the vote, there was no public hearing for district residents. And some of these public hearings that the council holds are often in the middle of the day at hours where people can't attend, lots of people can't attend. And so you're right, you end up having the same people coming and small numbers of people with big voices. And so the council panders to them because they're under the illusion that these are people who represent the entire city. They do not.
Well, and you know what? The council certainly hides behind emergency legislation. We talk about it as if, you know, this is something that we have to do because the mean old Congress won't let us make our own laws without letting them sit up on Capitol Hill for 30 legislative days. So this is an encumbrance under which we need to deal, but it's also become a methodology for them, a modus operandi for getting, just as you say, getting those things that they want to get through without any kind of interference from the electorate.
Exactly.
Well, let me ask you, what do you think of, you know, since I've been elected, Janetta, you've had Kwame Brown, Harry Thomas, Michael Brown, Jim Graham, Vincent Orange, Jack Evans, a whole list of people either go to jail, not get reelected because they were in the middle of some investigation into malfeasance by them. Do we have a corrupt government in the District of Columbia? Corrupt, I don't think in the traditional sense that we think of political corruption, but are we corrupt because we play it fast and loose?
I think that obviously there has been corruption in the government. I expect that there will be corruption in the government. The nature of politics and government is that there often is corruption. Yeah. You can go back to the beginning of the whole country and know that there was corruption. So I'm not surprised that there's corruption. I do think that we need to tighten our laws for how we deal with corruption and deal with unethical behavior. We created an office board of the Board of Government Ethics and Accountability. BEGA is what people call it. And I don't see it aggressively holding elected officials and even government managers to account for their behaviors that are loosey-goosey or on the fringe of being corrupt, certainly at the very least unethical. We just went through something where a candidate, Alyssa Silverman, who was a very good council member for many people and got herself involved in some behavior that was at least questionable Certainly the Board of Elections decided that the Office of Campaign Finance had made a mistake and that what she did was not illegal, was not a violation of the city's campaign finance laws. Everybody else, many, many people in the city thought it was. But it's that kind of behavior that is fuzzy. And that when you do what the Board of Elections did, which was to basically repeal the decision of its own agency, then you leave the door wide open for real corruption.
Yeah, you know, I've got to say that, first of all, I talked to the head of BEGA, and at the time, I was seeking an advisory opinion, and at the time he told me they only had one investigator to investigate me, to investigate 13 city council members, the mayor, the heads of all the agencies, all the ANC commissioners. They're even responsible for ANC commissioners, and they have one person to do this, and the person, I can't even remember his name, but he said, it's really almost impossible for us to stay on top of it. And you know, when I say playing it fast and loose, you know, I think we've seen that over and over again with, like, Kwame Brown ordering two SUVs on the first day of work, even though he wasn't entitled, right? And Jack Evans saying, hey, look, if you want to do business with the TC government, just call me on the phone and I'll set it up for you. I mean, you know, at times I look at the city council and I say they run themselves the way we used to run student government, you know, in high school. You flirted with my girlfriend, so you're not going to be on the prom committee, you know, that kind of thing. But yeah, that really bothers me. And I asked, is part of our problem that my favorite councilman of all time, Marion Barry, when he was mayor, set this system in motion by, you know, hiring a lot of people and what do you think of that? I mean, look, Marion Barry was nicer to me than anybody that's ever been on the city council. I admire his great political skill and how people admired him. But I've got to be honest with you. Every time I drive through Anacostia, which I do all the time, I say to myself, this man was in power for 40 years, and still look at the problems we have down here. What do you think about that? Did Marion Barry set the culture?
I wrote a book about Marion Barry. I didn't know that. The last of the black emperors in the new age of black leadership. I was one big critic of Marion Barry. I remain a critic of Marion Barry because, like you, I thought that he had the trust of the people.
Yes,
he was certainly a very skilled politician, charismatic, and yet he failed at so much. At one point under his leadership, there were six D.C. government agencies under court order or either in court receivership. And these were agencies that were crucial to low-income, working-class people, the Department of the Public Housing Department. You had schools, you had the Mental Health Commission, you name it, the D.C. Child and Family Services Agency was under court order for 32 years, and the child welfare system in this city is still messed up, and children are still not being protected, and some are being killed by their parents or their parent or their mother's paramour or father's paramour or some relative in their family. It's ridiculous what's happening in this city.
It is. It's horrible. And when you think, I sit on the board of directors of a nonprofit that, or of a foundation that puts several hundred thousand dollars a year into organization, nonprofit organizations in DC. And we take a long, hard look because we give grants of like $25,000. We don't give big, really, really big grants. And we look at all these small organizations that are trying to struggle with these problems. And sometimes it just amazes me. It amazes me. When I was first elected, 51% of the kids at Ballou High School did not graduate on time. And yeah. I'm sorry, at Anacostia High School did not graduate on time. And I thought to myself, how can it be that on the first day of school, the principal could assemble everybody and go, you're more likely not to graduate than you are to graduate? I mean, it's crazy. In a city which is the most educated city in the world, we have more per capita, more people with graduate degrees in the District of Columbia than any other city in the world. And yet we have these kids that fall through the cracks. And when we talk about education reform and we talk about a 10-year plan or a 15-year plan, I think about all the kids who are going to fall through the cracks in that 10-year period and maybe never be able to get their footing again. So, you know, it really bothers me to state we still have a bad education system in the District of Columbia. My kids went to DC public schools from pre-K through high school, but they went to good schools in Ward 3 where the parents were engaged, exactly what you talked about earlier, where the parents were engaged. And we don't see this in Ward 7 and 8, and we don't see a lot of wraparound services.
Well, what do you think we need to do? Say, in all fairness, I want to be fair in my criticism. Some people will say that what we're dealing with in the District of Columbia, when you opened your show, you had Sweet Honey in the Rock talking about no taxation and without representation.
Yes.
And that is kind of a slogan for what we're talking about in terms of racism and institutional racism. And so some people will blame a lot of what we're talking about, you know, the state of affairs of child welfare is comes from the level of discrimination that we've seen on black people and people of color in terms of labor laws and what was happening with that. They'll talk about economic injustice and inequity. And, of course, we know that that is true. It is a racist, classist society. And so there are, you know, these foundational things that where we find the root of many of these problems. However, I always say that we've been in charge, meaning people of color, black people especially, have been in charge for 40 years in the city. And even though you still have the Congress, the federal government, hovering over you and checking everything you're doing, there are some things that can be done better than we're doing it, even in that kind of an environment. I think about my own coming from Louisiana. I grew up in New Orleans and, you know, in a segregated society. And I think about what my grandfather, grandmother, my mother had to deal with. And I can assure you that their approach to it was a little bit different than the approach we're seeing now in this society where we've seen significant improvements for people of color.
Well, first of all, let me say that the two greatest weeks of my life were spent in a backwater called Chalmette in right outside of New Orleans.
Yes,
and I
yes.
can't say any more than that or I'll have to resign. But let me ask you about racism in America. We've seen lately First of all, we saw the thing with George Floyd, where America was horrified by, we actually watched a man get murdered on TV, right? We watched this ruthless racist cop kill this man. And you know, we were outraged, morally outraged, for a short period of time. It seems like we keep on getting morally outraged about things like this and the mass shootings like in Buffalo and South Carolina, and you know, and they're obviously all racially motivated. And we've seen a new uptick in anti-Semitism and attacks on Asian people. Is this something new? Is this a new variation of racism, like you know, like viruses mutate? Is this a mutation of racism, or is this just that America pushed racism in the 1960s and 70s, pushed it under the carpet?
I think the difference here is, I don't think it's new. I think it's always been there, under the cover, behind the scenes. That's why we had a civil rights movement. That's why we still have a very civil rights movement involving various communities in this country, because it has never gone away. I don't expect it to go away. What is troubling for me, and I think what is troubling for most people, is that you had a federal government, and in some instances, state governments that actually inspire racial behavior and condone it and defend it. We had somebody in the White House recently. Thank God he's gone, and hopefully they'll never people like him will never be back in charge. But he certainly he came into office spouting racial divisive language and advanced some of that while he was in office with executive orders and policies and programs. And so I think that is what, you know, what has happened is that there has been until recently a kind of an environment where this has been sort of suggested that this is the American way. And it, to a certain extent, I guess maybe at one point it was the American way, but we have become a much more advanced society, I think. And so people are a little bit more sensitive to it, and especially after the George Floyd murder, I think people became even more sensitive. So I think that there are people now who are fighting, publicly fighting, you know, against this. And corporations, individuals, various leaders. And so it's kind of hard, but it is out here, and it's always been out here. The question is, you know, how do you respond as an individual? And then how does your community respond?
And what about Donald Trump? What about him? What about, I went to a forum right after he was elected, and I had a woman stand up and say, as Democrats, we have nothing to apologize for. And all I could say to her was, of course we do. We need to apologize for this man getting elected. If we had done our job, would he have been able to get elected? So how much responsibility do liberals, how much responsibility do should we take for the fact that, you know, it seems that it's okay to be stupid and racist all of a sudden? You know, how much of that is on us? I'll ask you specifically that the University of Southern California just recently passed a regulation that says that the School of Social Work can no longer use the term field work or refer to themselves as a field because it's insulting to, you know, Mexicans who have picked fruit black people who come from slavery? I mean, don't we look foolish when we worry about things like that?
I think that trivializes the whole experience. I mean, I can't even. I just find that to be so ridiculous. I do. And I think that, you know, people think that they're being sensitive. I think that they're being, it is a form of pandering, and it's an insult to take it to that level. I think the problem that happened with Trump, who I do not like speaking about, because I think that when, you know, the more air you give him, the more power he has.
I agree.
I try not to give him too much air and too much attention, you know, because he is probably one of the worst people that I've met in my lifetime. I've met a lot of bad people, but he just at his core is evil. So the thing about what happened with Democrats, I think, what happens with people generally is that they act on their emotions. I like this person. I don't like that person. And I think in 2020 we saw that people now understand their civic responsibility goes beyond their pleasure. You can't be voting based on how you like somebody, but you have to vote on whether this person can sustain and grow the democracy for this country and introduce and support policies that are going to advance the society in general. And I think that what we did back in that election with Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton was that people personalized it. They didn't like her, and so they didn't go out to vote. It wasn't that they voted against her. They just didn't vote.
Yeah. No, that's true, and you have to be liked in politics, and it's very strange because I've often thought to myself, you know, what if I had to hire these people and I got their resumes and I saw, you know, 8 years in the White House, Secretary of State, United States Senator, and then I looked at Donald Trump and I said, reality TV guy, you know, why would, you know, how did the two of them even compare? And that's exactly right. It's that people didn't like her for some reason.
Yeah.
They didn't. You know, on they didn't like her personality, or whatever. But yeah, it's
an accomplished woman, and a woman who is as accomplished as she is a hard pill for some people to swallow.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true, and you know, and I think, With the minor exception that he got elected president, she was more accomplished than her husband in a lot of ways. You know, yeah, you have to be liked, and it's a really strange phenomenon in politics. Do you think, this is a personal opinion, you think that you shouldn't be given him any more airtime then it's absolutely necessary, and I agree. Should we leave them alone? Do we look stupid that every liberal in America came out and trashed him for keeping classified documents outside the White House, and now we're backstepping and right? I want to tell you the most important thing that I've heard said about this issue is the woman that from Saturday Night Live who was the host of the Daily Show and said, yes, this is a national security problem when we found out that Joe Biden had secret classified documents next to his Corvette. Oh, my God, why should a man this age have access to a Corvette? That's the real problem here, right? Is that nobody his age should be allowed to drive a car that goes 140 miles an hour.
Exactly.
And you know, it really, we just look foolish. And I see people that I have so much respect for on the Democratic side, like Congressman Schiff, up there trying to defend Joe Biden, saying, oh, well, you know, he had him in a lock, finally got him next to his car, and he's cooperating, and that's somehow different. Well, the American people, I don't think, parse it that far. You know, here in Washington, we like to cut everything up into little tiny pieces. But for the most part, I think people say, hey, he had the documents, you had the documents, give it up. Should we leave Donald Trump alone? My opinion is that we should leave him alone, that we should invoke the clause under the 14th Amendment that says if you're involved in insurrection, you can never again run for public office, and we should leave it at that. Let's make sure the man never runs for anything again and leave him alone. He's never going to jail. He's never going
to jail. Well, I think he should go to jail. Listen, I tell people all the time, my grandmother was very conservative about law and order, and I would imagine a lot of black people are. With law and order, I think that's probably why there's so much support for the mayor around this, for her veto of the revised criminal code, is because there are many people in this city who believe that when you commit a crime, you should be held accountable. If that means you go to jail, you go to jail. But when you commit a crime, you have to be held accountable. No one is above the law. And because Donald Trump was involved, he didn't just sit on the sidelines and people were acting on his behalf. He stirred the whole January 6th action. And he was leading the insurrection. And so even if it was, at the White House, which made it even worse. And so, I think he should go to jail. Now, will he go to jail for that? Probably not. Will he go to jail because he took classified documents and refused to turn them over to the National Archives and lied about them? Probably not. I don't know. He may never go to jail, but I think we should pursue him for the laws that he broke. And I also think he shouldn't go. He should never, ever be allowed to run for office and to hold office, any kind of office. I don't even think he should be a sheriff, a local sheriff. No, you can't be anything. Well, maybe he shouldn't be a local sheriff, especially because of his hateful, and racist ways. So, I do think there's a problem. But here's the other thing, though, Senator Brown. This whole notion that, classified documents could be found near a Corvette or and in somebody's resort. These are problems. Like, what are these classified documents? And how is it that it's so easy for you to just take them out of the? There should be a system where that really tracks the way people are handling classified documents. Are you telling me that no one knew that there were more than two dozen documents that left the White House when Joe Biden left? They didn't know that there were classified documents that left when Donald Trump left? Who's keeping up with these classified documents?
Well, I think when I think of him, I think of what my grandmother used to say, a woman who only took her apron off to go to church on Sunday, and that is that she had bigger fish to fry. She would always say that. You would do a little thing, and she would say, you would come to her with some minor complaint, and she would say, I have bigger fish to fry. But I understand why people want to prosecute him. I just don't know what good it does for the the country, and I wonder if it doesn't add to the narrative of you know, that we're trying to persecute them somehow. You know, I've got to tell you that every black person that I knew, every friend I had, and I didn't have many that were for him, but on a rare occasion when a black person would tell me that they supported Donald Trump, I always said to them, do you understand he doesn't like black people? I mean, yeah. He doesn't. He's a racist. And, you know, to this day, I would love to go to Georgia and walk up to everybody that voted for Marjorie Taylor Greene and say, what were you thinking?
Yeah.
I mean, oh, my God. Really, you should be embarrassed that you voted for this person. And,
well, I think when you create an environment, the environment in which we are nationally, that is, the national environment, which I think trickles down, I guess, to the local level, is that some people are really afraid that white people are losing control.
Oh, yeah.
And
absolutely.
and so they are doing, some of them are doing everything they can to try to hold on to the control. It's a little late for that. The country has been changing over the last 20 or 30 years, maybe even before then. And so as black people and brown people and Asian people began to become become leaders in various industries and in this society, it is becoming more and more diverse.
And I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was just going to say, and I find that most white people have a hard time understanding how they benefited from white privilege. I was lucky. I grew up as a kid, a young child, in North New Jersey, in just a cesspool of a city. My parents moved me out of there when I was 12 years old. My father abandoned my family. My mother died. I was an orphan on my own who had to work to put myself through school and everything. But I lived in Montgomery County. There were lots of people that rushed in to help me, to support me. And I think to myself, if I lived in inner city D.C. or I lived in inner city Baltimore, because I used to go back to North to visit my grandmother, and I saw how people lived, I would have never made it. But I made it in Montgomery County because they allowed me to act out all over the place, and people rushed in to help me. And so I am such a beneficiary of white privilege. And I don't think most people see that. And I think they do see it slipping away. You know, when we talk about the good old days, they weren't so good for a lot of people, right?
No.
They were only good for a handful. Full of us, right?
Yeah.
So it's certainly my
well,
my
and it wasn't
sister,
so good for some of the white people either.
Well, that's
but the,
true.
The white people didn't realize that because the people that were in charge looked like them, and so they had the aspirations or the belief that they could move up the ladder. Some of them actually did, who
right.
certainly didn't deserve it. But, you know, the point, though, I think is if you don't set a standard in your society, it's like in your family. If you don't set a standard in your family, you know, what is appropriate behavior? What is appropriate language? What is, you know, how you should treat each other in that family and how you should treat your neighbors? All of that is critical to having a healthy society. And so you can't let people just commit crimes and not be held accountable, whether
right.
it's a carjacking, a robbery, walking around with a gun and accidentally shooting two children because you're trying to shoot somebody else for some petty beef, or you're trying to shoot somebody else because they're entering your drug territory, or you took some classified documents, or you raped a woman, and swear to God, you didn't rape her. But instead, we hear you on a broadcast talking about grabbing women. All of these are crimes that have to be, and people who commit them have to be held accountable.
Well, and you're right about the standards your family sets, because, you know, I am one of three children. My brother was president of a college. My sister was a senior partner in a law firm, and I dropped out of high school. And I went back and I got a master's degree. And people asked me, I got a GED, and I ultimately got a master's degree. And people said, well, what motivated you to do that? And I say, often, I would have never been acceptable to my family with a 10th grade education. If I found a way to make $10 million, my grandmother would have said to me, great, now you can go back to school and get an education. Because that's the way we're brought up, right? Those were the standards they set for us. Right. Well, Jeanetta Rose Barris, we're out of time. Is there anything you want to add?
No, thank you very much for allowing me to have this chat with you this evening. It's been quite informative, I think, and it's been a lot of fun.
And the honor is mine. I am a big fan, and I encourage everybody to read what you write on the DC line, because you really write some really great stuff that gets right to the point and is always not only worth reading, but often very entertaining as well. We always leave our show with a song, usually dedicated to our guests. But tonight, I'm going to take a special privilege because a man that helped orchestrate my youth, David Crosby, passed away this week. So we're going to play in the Year of the Rabbit. Happy Lunar New Year's to all my Chinese friends out there. It's the Year of the Rabbit, and we're supposed to be more introspective. So thank you, Jeanetta Rose Barris. I hope you'll come back again sometime. And this song goes out to you and everybody else in America in tribute to David Crosby. May he rest in peace. Here's one from the Birds. Thanks, folks. See you next week.
Thank you.
Give the people their right to vote.